Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who assesses the ongoing violence between Israelis and Palestinians and the prospects for a ceasefire leading to negotiations. Nation magazine columnist John Nichols, who looks at the power shift in the U.S. Senate after Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party, giving control to the Democrats. And Michael Marriott, executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, who examines the case being made for a revival of nuclear power by the Bush administration. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ago, during the presidency of George Bush Sr., public concern about the effects of dioxin resulted in chemical and paper industries requesting health studies. The companies hoped that further research might make the compound seem less threatening. The EPA responded by producing a 3,200-page, decade-long study titled The Dioxin Reassessment, which the present policy director, Dwayne Winters, has called one of the strongest pieces of science the agency has ever done. But now, according to The Nation magazine, the same dioxin manufacturers that initially wanted the study done are having second thoughts about the given conclusions. Dioxin has moved from being a potential health risk to a known health risk that may cause cancer in 1 out of 100 high-risk individuals. The precise degree of danger is hard to determine since dioxin is stored in fatty tissue and is affected by diet and the length of exposure. Now, the current Bush administration is being pressured to keep on doing peer reviews of the study until it goes away. Industry-funded scientists connected with the study have acted to delay and weaken the conclusions whenever possible. In one instance, industry experts argued that a low dose of dioxin could actually be of some use in treating breast cancer. This claim is made despite dioxin's documented toxicity at levels as low as one part per billion. So, the fractious debate goes on, leaving observers to wonder when, if ever, the report will officially be released. In the isolated health clinics of the Ural Mountains, the Russian tuberculosis epidemic is growing. Hundreds of cases of advanced TB are filling the wards, and the doctors can offer little hope or medicine to treat the deadly disease. According to the World Press Review magazine, over 3 million Russians suffer from TB and hundreds die each year, and the disease is being spread into Western Europe. The health crisis is expected to get worse as prison inmates with a high rate of TB are released and return home. The crisis is critical, and medical teams from the World Health Organization, Germany and the United States have gone to rural Russia to help contain the spread of infection. In a recent report, the Harvard Medical School called the Russian TB crisis an epidemiological Chernobyl. The standard World Health Organization 6-month anti-TB treatment is rarely followed in Russia. TB patients usually leave before the treatment is complete, either because the hospital runs out of drugs or the patients, who are mostly poor, cannot afford the daily treatments. As a result, TB bacteria is only partially killed off. Then it recovers and becomes even more dangerous as it develops resistance to existing anti-TB medications. Robert Lodenkemper of the German Central Committee Against Tuberculosis observes, "The drug resistance situation in the high-risk parts of Europe is a ticking time bomb." Throughout the April 2021 protests outside the Free Trade Area of the Americas Summit in Quebec City, the Seattle Independent Media Center, or IMC, was busy posting the latest developments on its popular internet website and getting the latest reports from anti-corporate globalization protests at the US-Canadian border in Blaine, Washington. But the buzz of online activity came to a quick halt around 7 p.m. when the FBI came knocking on April 21st. According to the news magazine In These Times, two FBI agents and a US customs agent delivered a sealed court order seeking the IMC's user connection logs for the 2 days of protests. US authorities claim that two of the IMC postings violated Canadian law because they contained stolen police documents. The documents featured President George W. Bush's travel schedule in Quebec City and Canadian police strategies to counter FTAA street protests. Now, attorneys for the Seattle IMC are trying to get the FBI to narrow the scope of its search order. They fear the court order and FBI presence is designed to harass anti-free trade activists. Attorney David Berman, who represents the IMC, feels important free speech rights are at stake. He says that Canadian law enforcement is stepping over the line from a legitimate investigation to trampling the rights of the press and free speech of internet users. Many observers say this could be a precedent-setting case, clarifying the application of the First Amendment to the internet. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Fraser. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
After 8 months of escalating violence, resulting in the deaths of more than 500 mostly Palestinian civilians, Israelis and Palestinians have taken tentative steps to resuming security talks. This comes after the Bush administration gave up its low-profile approach and directed U.S. Envoy William Burns to engage in shuttle diplomacy between the two sides. But the outlook for any breakthroughs is uncertain after continued car bombings and military attacks, despite a limited unilateral Israeli ceasefire. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's strategy of preemptive strikes, which has included targeting Palestinian leaders for assassination, has failed to quell the Al-Aqsa Intifada or uprising. Hope for a resumption of negotiations further dimmed as Israel flatly rejected a freeze on Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, a key recommendation from an international commission led by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, communications director with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who assesses provisions of the Mitchell plan and the prospects for a ceasefire and renewed negotiations.
I think there was a great deal of emphasis the Mitchell Commission placed on a need to end the violence, and that's fine. And that's certainly what Secretary of State Powell and President Bush and most of the other American officials who comment on the matter also emphasize, the need to end the violence. The problem is they have a rather restrictive definition of violence, which seems to, in their minds, only refer to physical attacks by one person on another person. I would argue very strongly that not only are those violent acts, but home demolitions are violent, ripping up of orchard groves are violent. In other words, making people impoverished and homeless is violent. The seizure of land, settlement activity, taking land from one group of people because of their ethnicity and giving it to another group of people because of their ethnicity. In this case, it's taking land from Palestinians and giving them to Jewish Israeli settlers. That is also violent, in fact. And I would go further and say that the occupation itself is a psychological, economic, political, and ultimately physically violent reality. So in the end, if you want to genuinely stop the violence, you have to end the occupation. But particularly, cannot have a return to normalcy. In other words, a tranquil situation appertaining for both Israelis and Palestinians, where the Israeli occupation can just go ahead in peace and quiet. I think Palestinians are just not prepared to accept that. And it's particularly important with regard to the settlements. The Mitchell Commission did suggest that a total freeze on all settlement activity needs to go ahead in order to achieve some kind of end to the violence. And I think this is the insight that they had, which is the most useful. And this is the one which Secretary Powell downplayed very greatly when he presented the report to the press. But it's there. It's very clearly in the report that all settlement activity, including what the Israelis call natural growth, must cease. Now, the Israeli government won't discuss ending the settlement. It would be completely anathema for not only for a Sharon government, but also a Barak government, and even a Rabin government to have considered it. I mean, all governments in Israel since 1993 have engaged in massive settlement activity. In fact, none more vigorously than that of Ehud Barak, the supposed Duff. So really, this is the key, I think, for any kind of plan to be effective. But as things stand, there is no real diplomatic effort in spite of the shuttle diplomacy, because it's the official position and the actual position also of the Sharon government that they will not talk to Palestinians as long as there is any kind of revolt in progress. And until they can go back to occupying the land and building settlements in tranquility, they will not even consider sitting down at the negotiating table. And that's their position. So obviously the Israeli intention is to effect a military solution, and they're going about trying to do that. Of course, it will fail.
The Israeli government may think that they can reach a military solution here through the barrel of a gun, changing the Palestinian rejection of negotiating their statehood in a very fundamental way. But it seems that the Israeli government can only pursue a military solution if they have backing from Washington to do so. And I'm wondering what you see as the Bush administration's position in this, given that they're really the only effective force with leverage over the Israeli government.
Right now, the Israelis asked for and received a carte blanche from the Bush administration to go ahead and do what they want. The thing is, I think that both Israel and Washington face the long-term prospect of becoming exhausted in this campaign. What they're trying to do in effecting a military solution is beat people into submission, kill enough Palestinians, destroy their economy sufficiently, and simply make it too tough for them to continue a rebellion so that they will come back to the negotiating table, as you implied, and accept Israel's terms, which involves what the kind of thing that Ehud Barak was proposing at Camp David in July, which is not Palestinian independence, but some sort of Palestinian entity, a quote state, close quote. This conflict is going to deteriorate. It's going to get more vicious. Both sides are going to get more vicious. The whole thing is just going to get worse. It is. People talk about it getting out of control. Believe me, it's completely out of control already. It is utterly and totally out of control. And that is going to confront everybody in the world, particularly in Israel and the United States, with the question, are they willing to support this? Don't forget, we supply everything to the Israelis. We give them $5.5 billion of aid per year. They are wholly dependent on the United States, particularly militarily. The only way our country, the United States, could be more heavily involved in this hideous conflict is if we had our own young men and women fighting alongside the Israelis, shooting down Palestinians in the streets.
That was Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 202-244-2990 or visit their website at www.adc.org. The White House and Republicans across the nation were shocked by the news when two-term Vermont Senator James Jeffords announced that he was leaving the Republican Party to become an independent. The historic switch, officially declared by Jeffords on May 24th, gave control of an evenly split Senate to the Democrats for the first time since 1995. Other moderate Republicans warned that the Bush administration's hard-right agenda might trigger more defections in the near future. Since the swearing-in of George W. Bush as president January 20th, the Republicans had enjoyed control of the legislative and executive branches of government for the first time since the Eisenhower administration. With the Democrats now in control of Senate committees, political observers say it will be more difficult for Mr. Bush to push through controversial conservative judicial nominees. But Democrats will not have an easy time challenging the Bush program, as they too are divided along ideological lines, a fact made clear by the 12 Democratic senators who recently voted with the GOP in support of the Bush tax cut legislation, the largest giveaway to the rich since the Reagan era. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with The Nation magazine's online beat columnist John Nichols, who looks at the power shift in the U.S. Senate and how these changes could affect the future direction of U.S. politics.
Well, Jim Jeffords is a really interesting player. His family, his ancestors, joined the Republican Party in 1857. I mean, they are truly old line New England Republicans rooted in the party when it was actually a pretty noble party, founded to oppose slavery and to support a bigger federal government that was very interested in public works programs and very much more of an environmental party, much more of a party that supported civil rights and women's rights than the Democrats used to. So his roots go back to a Republican Party that I think even a lot of progressives could have a measure of respect for. And for a very, very long time, Jeffords, who got into politics more than 30 years ago, tried to sort of maintain the fantasy of a Republican Party that was at least moderate, even, I think, to his taste, somewhat liberal. And finally, when the Bush folks came along, I think he realized the lie that he was living, frankly. I mean, it was no longer possible in a Bush and Tom DeLay Washington to tell yourself that the Republican Party had any relationship to the party of Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt or even, frankly, Dwight Eisenhower.
John Nichols, tell us a little bit about Tom Daschle, who now becomes the majority leader of the Senate. What kind of politician and leader is Daschle?
Daschle is a liberal. His voting record is actually pretty good from an AFL-CIO and Sierra Club and environmental standpoint. He's not a lefty by any measure, but I would paint him several steps to the left of Bill Clinton and Al Gore, a couple steps to the right of Ted Kennedy and Paul Wellstone.
Now, what power does the shift in the U.S. Senate give the Democrats to confront, challenge, and maybe even defeat certain parts of the Bush administration agenda?
Well, it gives them a lot of power, not in straight up and down votes, because, as you've noted, there are several conservative Democrats like Zell Miller and Ben Nelson and even John Breaux and others who might go wrong on some of these issues. But the real power is in the committees. And when you control the committee structure of the Senate, you have an immense ability to, frankly, bury bills that you don't like or to alter them in negotiation processes with the administration. So my bet is that you're going to see a lot of legislation simply disappear into subcommittees and committees. You'll also see a lot of legislation restructured because the Bush administration simply will have to accept compromises to get it onto the floor of the Senate. Most significantly, you're going to see a lot of shift on the judicial nominations. Up until a week ago, George W. Bush was well-positioned to put forward the most conservative nominees he liked because, frankly, Orrin Hatch was going to get them through the Judiciary Committee and to the floor, and once they got to the floor, there was a likelihood that they'd be accepted. Now you have the Judiciary Committee run by Pat Leahy and Ted Kennedy, and, frankly, it's going to be a lot harder to get those nominees out. I don't think you're going to see a full-force challenge to the Bush presidency from the Democrats in the Senate or the House. That, if it was going to happen, would have happened right away, and it did. Frankly, if the Democratic Party had its act together and really was ideological and really was committed to battling the Bush agenda, they would have fought Bush last fall over Florida. The bottom line is that Al Gore folded at a point when he should have kept on fighting. He never fought hard enough on issues of racial disqualification and disenfranchisement. And so I really think the Democratic Party is still way short of the sort of coherence and passion that you see from particularly the right wing of the Republican Party. At the best, I think they can stop Bush from doing some bad things. Certainly the new circumstance is a better circumstance than the old one, but it's unrealistic to think that, you know, we've suddenly moved to some sort of New Deal type coherent Democratic force challenging the Republicans.
John Nichols, how do you explain the fact that the Democrats, having won in the battle for the White House the majority of the popular vote, and certainly one of the most controversial endgames of any presidential election in our recent history, how do you explain their acquiescence to the Bush agenda?
Well, the Democratic Party is an incoherent party. You have a very conservative wing within the party that is extremely tied to the same corporate interests that the Republican Party is tied to. They are frankly indistinguishable on economic issues. This is the Democratic Leadership Council and the Blue Dog Democrats from the South. In addition, frankly, the overall crisis of campaign finance corruption has caused many Democrats who ought to be much more independent thinking to essentially collapse into a moderately conservative position.
That was Nation Magazine columnist John Nichols. Visit the Nation Magazine's website at www.thenation.com. The last time a contract was signed to build a nuclear power plant in the U.S. was in 1978, just before the near disaster at Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island plant and the later tragedy at Chernobyl. But nuclear power's problems, such as how to safely store tons of dangerous radioactive waste, remain unresolved. A long-term waste storage site at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, has never opened due to continuing questions about its safety. But the nuclear industry, with help from the Bush administration's recently unveiled energy plan, hopes to revive atomic power, which currently supplies the nation 20% of its energy. In addition to drilling for oil in places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the White House energy plan calls for hundreds of new fossil fuel and nuclear power plants over the next 20 years. Vice President Cheney ironically promotes nuclear power as a clean energy source that doesn't produce greenhouse gases, even as his administration dismisses the issue of global warming. According to recent opinion polls, the public, opposed to polluting fossil fuels and fearful of a looming energy crisis, is looking more favorably on nuclear power than it has in decades. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Marriott, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, about the Bush plan to revive nuclear power, an industry that until recently appeared headed for a slow death.
They talk about relicensing the existing reactors and trying to streamline that process, although it's actually difficult to imagine how the process could be any more streamlined than it already is, because the public has already essentially shut out of the relicensing process. The document calls for a reauthorization of the Price-Anderson Act that expires next summer. The Price-Anderson Act is the legislation that limits the utility industry's liability in the event of a nuclear accident.
There's been talk, at least in other reports I've read, about reprocessing spent fuel. Could you address that, what the reprocessed fuel would be used for and what the dangers of that are?
Sure. That is another element of the energy plan, is for the U.S. to take another look at reprocessing nuclear fuel. Reprocessing has been banned in this country since the 1970s, but there's a new interest in it among some elements of the nuclear power industry and among, in this case, what's critically important is among some key U.S. senators like Pete Domenici of New Mexico. And reprocessing essentially means taking the irradiated fuel that's been in a nuclear reactor and stripping out, well, normally what you strip out is the plutonium, and turning that into a new fuel. First of all, it's very dirty environmentally. It's an absolute disaster. It's also a proliferation problem. Because what you're doing is you're separating out the plutonium, which, of course, is the major ingredient of a hydrogen bomb. If plutonium becomes a commodity that has a value on the world market and is, you know, part of world trade, sooner or later some of it's going to be diverted. And the final problem, of course, is that it's ludicrously expensive. There's a huge glut of uranium on the world market, and there's just no need for reprocessing nuclear fuel.
Could you address the issue that this proposal to sort of reinvigorate the nuclear power industry seems to be driving a wedge between workers and unions who are actually kind of, some of whom are embracing this idea that to build new nuclear plants or recommission existing plants and provide more work, and environmentalists who are very concerned for environmental reasons and public health reasons about creating more nuclear power?
Well, I'm not sure how real that wedge actually is. The building trades unions and a few unions like that do tend to support nuclear power and nuclear plant construction, and they always have. For them, it is a major source of jobs. However, when you look at the nuclear issue in terms of jobs generally, nuclear power is the most capital-intensive way of producing electricity, meaning that it requires a lot of money. It actually does not require a large amount of workers. You know, it takes far more workers to build 1,000 megawatts of wind turbines than it does to build 1,000 megawatts of nuclear power plants.
Michael, could you speak to what exactly your organization is doing? You've been working all along for many years on issues related to nuclear power.
Well, first of all, I mean, some of the things that we're trying to do is point out some of the very basic fallacies of the plan. And I'll give you just two examples. One is that the administration and the nuclear industry are not being honest with the American people, because if, for example, a significant number of the existing reactors were relicensed, and or if any significant number of new nuclear plants were built, then we would need a second high-level nuclear waste dump, and we don't even have a first one yet. And of course, there are a lot of us who believe that Yucca Mountain itself is unsuitable for nuclear waste storage, and is by no means a done deal. It may be that we'll have to find two new nuclear waste dumps, and of course, if there's one thing that the public has shown repeatedly, it's that nobody wants a nuclear waste dump nearby. Another fallacy that we're trying to point out is the whole notion that we need 400,000 megawatts of new power, which is what the energy plan calls for. 90,000 megawatts of new power already are under construction and scheduled to come online in just the next 18 months. The Department of Energy released a report recently which showed that simple, cost-effective energy efficiency measures, by the way, which are also major job creation measures, could obviate the need to build 180,000 megawatts of new power. Renewable sources, according to the same report, could provide 50,000 megawatts of new power over the next 20 years.
That was Michael Marriott, Executive Director with the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Contact the service by calling area code 202-328-0002 or visit their website at www.nirs.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is celebrating its 10th anniversary with an audio CD featuring interviews from our archive with noted analysts and activists such as Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and Helen Caldicott on important issues and events of the last decade. If you are interested in obtaining the CD or a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines at area code 203-331-9756 or visit our website at www.vtlonline.org. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Prue Cullen, Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.